Welcome to the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action by the Center for Humanitarian Action in Berlin. My name is Annette Ritschler and I'm the communications manager at CHA. On day two of the CHA conference, Janani Vivekananda joined our panel on fragility, conflict and violence in the face of climate change. And afterwards, CHA director Ralf Süthoff could welcome her to the chat room to talk about how climate change affects conflict dynamics.
Janani, it's a great pleasure having you at the CHA podcast. We welcome today Janani Vivekananda, who is the head of program Climate Diplomacy and Security at Adelphi in Berlin. And for everybody internationally out there who might not know Adelphi yet in the humanitarian world, of course, we come back to that and we'll share that. Janani has been our panelist here where we do this podcast also at the CHA annual conference about climate change and humanitarian crisis. And we are very pleased that she's joining us today also for a podcast. Many thanks and welcome to the CHA podcast here in Berlin.
Thank you so much, Ralf. It's a pleasure to be here and thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. As said, you are the head of program right now at Adelphi, and you are working as a field researcher, as a practitioner. You have a really broad horizon. You are a policy advisor on climate change, peace and security for over 18 years, I learned. And before joining Adelphi, you were the head of environment, climate change and security at International Alert, but you also worked for Plan International and UNDP as an advisor, which is an impressive outline. So we are really looking forward to share. And maybe in a nutshell, just for the international audience or people who are not that close to the climate community, maybe as many humanitarians, of course, listen in here. What's Adelphi doing in a nutshell?
So Adelphi is a think tank based in Berlin. We're about 300 plus people. And the team that I lead, we focus on climate peace and the links between climate peace and security and climate diplomacy in terms of doing the research, understanding what these interactions look like. And then we work with policymakers, national, international, to then feed this knowledge and analysis into trying to affect policy change. But Adelphi as a whole, it does everything from everything climate and sustainable development, from green energy transition to carbon credits to peace and conflict.
Very impressive. 300 people, if we ever reach that with CHA, that will be my legacy, but I won't reach that level in my lifetime. We like to start this podcast with asking people how they have been motivated, what was maybe a moment in life making them engaging in the sector they are in. Is there anything you could share, an anecdote or a story where you really thought, oh, that's really my field?
So I have to say I was somewhat coerced into working on climate peace and security. I think I fell into it. My background is peace building, and ethnically I'm Sri Lankan. I'm a Tamil Sri Lankan, and I knew that I wanted to work on peace and security and peace building because my family story is one of conflict and having to adapt and flee conflict, essentially. So this I knew. But I didn't want to, even though conflict isn't a cheerful or light topic, I didn't want to work on climate change because the idea overwhelmed me. You know, conflict ends. Even if it's a long time, it ends. There's an self-interested reason for conflict to end for all conflict parties generally, but not with climate change. So I found this so overwhelming that I didn't want to work on this. But I got forced to co-author a report with my boss at the time in 2005 called A Climate of Conflict. And because he was not just my boss, but also the head of the organization of International Alert, I couldn't really say no. But there I could see, gosh, this is really something that's important. If we want to work on peace, we really can't be ignoring climate. And so, yeah, the rest is my history.
And apparently you didn't regret it.
No,
you
I didn't
stayed
look back.
To the sector, and we all benefited from your expertise and that you stayed on. A key area of your work, indeed, is the interlinkage between climate change and climate issues on security side, on peace building, etc. And we often talk, as you also did in our panel at this conference, talk about climate change as a threat multiplier, and especially in fragile and conflict conflict-affected settings. That's the key issue we hear. Why is that? Can you outline that in a nutshell?
Sure. So I didn't actually use the term threat multiplier in my input, and there's a reason for this. So we often hear this term threat multiplier when describing climate change, and it was a helpful term when it was coined about 17 years ago. But I find it personally of limited value now. It doesn't help us understand what to do about the problem. So it came from a military source. It came from a report by the Center for Naval Analysis, an American military think tank. And then it had a purpose. It was a really helpful way for those kind of right-leaning, hawkish Republicans kind of within the electorate and politicians to see climate change not as a kind of lefty environmental thing, but something that was really core to the thing that they're interested in, which is national security and international security. So to frame it in this military way was helpful, but now it carries these hard security connotations, which sometimes can push people away from actually understanding what it really means. And also, it doesn't help us understand the specifics of what those risks actually look like and then what to do about them. So we just talk about it at this top level. It's a threat multiplier, but it doesn't guide us towards any solutions. So I find it more helpful to think about how climate change affects conflict dynamics and it hinders peace. I set out some pathways in the input, and I think this is a much more meaningful way to understand the ways in which climate change, and also not just climate change, but when we're thinking about how these impacts affect conflict in fragile settings, climate doesn't do this in isolation. It's also other environmental changes, such as loss of biodiversity and pollution and land degradation, other kind of environmental risks, but also all the socio-political and economic risks in a context, and understand these interactions and then understand how it affects human security. So not this kind of hard security frame, but understanding how it affects people's ability to live their lives and pursue their livelihoods.
So maybe jumping to the next question, because that is right on climate as a security issue, and you named that already. And interestingly, at this conference, we try to link the humanitarian community and the climate one. And there is a linkage in this debate, definitely, because there is much discussion if humanitarian aid, if development aid, isn't also a security issue and should be considered in that regard. And there is this parallel discussion if climate isn't also a security issue. So from your view, is it helpful to link it and to link it also in an advocacy way? And is it justified from your experience by your analysis? Or what are the pros and cons and using this narrative?
I think it's very helpful. I think it's not just a narrative. It is a reality that these risks, they do interact, and they can't really be looked at in isolation. The risks that people face and whether they manifest in conflict or other kinds of humanitarian crises, the causes are so compound, so we have to understand them in their complexity. We need to understand how climate or environmental risk has interacted with other contextual factors like marginalization or poverty or inequitable governance structures. So I think it's really core. I don't like using this terminology of nexus because it just leads to eyes being rolled in every corner. But I think by looking at climate and security together, it really helps us understand these risks in the round. And when I'm asked to unpack it, or when I'm actually working with actors, humanitarian actors or defense actors or development actors and actually kind of doing trainings or capacity support, they'll say, well, this isn't that different from a conflict analysis that you're asking us to do. And I feel good about this because I'm saying, I think, well, yes, that's the point. It's nothing new. It's a conflict analysis is understanding the context, understanding the power dynamics, the political economy, the environment. But it just means that we're moving a little bit further, not just looking at the environment at that given moment, which is what we had, you know, in the 90s and into the 2000s. You know, if you do an environmental impact assessment, you look at the impact of your humanitarian programming on the environment, now, but you don't look at it in the future. So you're not aware of the impacts that you have on undermining resilience to risks that are not that far in the future. It's, you know, 3 years, 5 years, even 6 months. So it's just about ensuring that our current context analyses and climate assessments are, you know, ready for these 21st century challenges. It's nothing particularly new. It's just ensuring that how we look at the context isn't static anymore. It takes account of the fact that there is now uncertainty and variability built into the system, and humanitarian programming, even if we don't know how to plan for that uncertainty, needs to be designed in such a way that it will do no harm for a range of possible climate futures that might play out.
Maybe looking into this sometimes also tension between climate action and humanitarian action, or also from a do-no-harm perspective. But maybe it's one step back for colleagues out there who don't know yet your analysis, how climate and conflict are interrelated. Can you share just quickly what's your analysis? Why is it so obvious beyond anecdotal evidence in a given country, which of course we all know some examples, but it's going well beyond that, if I'm not misled.
Yes, absolutely. So we know that climate impacts everyone. There's not a single place in the world that isn't affected by climate change. But when we think about our responses, humanitarian responses or adaptation responses to help communities adapt to the impacts of climate change, we're not, you know, desperate to rush to the communities of the Netherlands to help them with their, you know, increased risk of flooding. We're not supporting those in, I don't know, Switzerland.
Or southern Germany these days, hit by a flood. But of course, that's not a
humanitarian issue. Yeah, you don't see the, you know, the diaspora of Pakistan coming together to help those poor Bavarian families whose cellars have been flooded. Not to say that these are not, you know, devastating for everyone involved. The point is that people are affected, but not everyone is affected equally. Some people are more vulnerable. Everyone faces this exposure. Some people are more vulnerable because they do not have the same coping capacities. So in southern Germany, people have insurance. There's a national government. There's a local government. It's not always ideal, but your life will not necessarily be utterly decimated such that you have no prospects. And so when we think about climate, supporting those affected by these climate impacts, we're thinking about the support for those where there are no social safety nets. You know, people can't leave necessarily because they don't have transport. Their regions are so remote, there is no road infrastructure. Or they're scared of leaving, even if you have the best early warning systems that say the flood is coming. They're afraid to leave because they don't have land rights. So if they leave, they will lose their land, and the national or local government may not be supportive because they're probably on this land because they are already socially ostracized or marginalized. So these are the reasons that kind of climate adaptation and humanitarian response and climate prevention efforts go to, or should go to, some places over others. And I think that, yeah, there is this tension between climate action and humanitarian action, because climate action can sometimes be seen in a very technical way. And that means you kind of take the people out of the response and you look at the hazard, and you then build flood defenses, or, you know, you look at the problem and you try to fix the problem, but you don't look at the root causes of the problem, like what is making people vulnerable to that problem. So you're trying to prevent the flood rather than look at why people are living in the floodplain. They're living in the floodplain because they've got nowhere else to live. And why do they live? Why do they have nowhere else to live? Because of political marginalization. So for me, it's very important that climate action, be it adaptation or mitigation or loss and damage, is, we had this in the session today, people-centered. So understanding not just the physical hazard, but actually the political economy of why people are vulnerable to that hazard, and actually take account of the power and the small p politics of this all, because technical solutions will never address the problem in a sustainable way. And then the other side of that is that humanitarian responses are often very people-centered, but don't take account of the bigger picture of in terms of the longevity of the impacts of a humanitarian intervention, like a camp. I don't know, you all know this, that the average lifespan of a IDP camp now is, what, 20 or 30 years?
26 years, I think.
So if you're building this And I'm sure you get 6 month funding cycles, which are very challenging to do long-term planning in. But if you're building this and these camps will need electricity and water, plus many other things, this is going to have a huge impact on the environment, but also people's climate vulnerability. So if the energy use and the water use is not kind of climate sensitive, then this is in itself going to cause a huge problem.
Right. And at the same time, not necessarily conflict sensitive, if I understand correct your analysis, because a lot of the conflicts coming out of these climate impacts and about competition over resources is then feeding into conflict. You shared great analysis in your previous inputs, how interrelated countries are in the sense that who's hit by climate change, it's basically the same ones getting peace-building funding. So you can really see that there is this link in the hotspots all over the world, if that's a fair summary of what you analysed.
Yes. So there is that, I showed this map of where there is peace building funding and where is affected by climate change. So that's a correlation. But if we went into and analyse that, we would see that it's not simply a correlation. It's not necessarily causal in terms of the climate isn't causing those conflicts and the conflict isn't kind of increasing vulnerability in and of itself to climate risks. But what you would see as a common factor is three things. One is that these are predominantly countries that are agrarian. Their economies are dependent, disproportionately dependent on climate sensitive sectors such as agriculture. They have weak governance. So those governments are not able to safeguard those communities from the risks posed by climate change. And they have a history of conflict. So those are kind of some of the mediating factors that will determine whether, you know, that double vulnerability really kind of locks in or not. The other thing I'd say in this is that we could look at the financing. Yes, it receives kind of peace building financing, or there might be UN missions in these some of these countries, most of these countries. It doesn't mean that financing is addressing the complexity of these risks. But to be more positive, if I take the example of UN peace building funding, that is one of the few funding streams that is actually doing some really innovative and exciting work to embed climate risk analysis into its peace building work. And not just to ensure that it does no harm, but it also to use climate and environment as an entry point sometimes where you can't access certain spaces through other more contentious channels. You know, as a UN agency, you can't, you know, that the state may or may not be benevolent, and you can't go in and talk about weak governance or governance failures explicitly, but sometimes, and also as a UN agency, you can't go in without the consent of the sovereign state. But sometimes climate provides a kind of a safer, softer entry point to actually still do this work on governance, but kind of do it under cover almost, because the government won't feel so threatened because climate change is not their fault. But it also enables that kind of double dividend to be met, for example, by designing peace-building programming, which is addressing people's climate resilience. So we came across, or we've been working with the team in Haiti. And there's, you know, huge instability and real trouble with gangs. And this work around peace-building is about providing green jobs. So addressing that kind of huge problem and conflict driver of youth unemployment and kind of social exclusion, but also locking in a more environmentally sustainable economy and livelihood pathway for these communities. So there are some small examples, but they're all very kind of localized. And what we're not seeing is this happening at scale.
Now, that's a very interesting point, and many thanks also for sharing the good news, how, for example, climate action can sometimes more easily introduce in a given setting and under a given government.
At the same time, we heard the bad news also at our conference, for example, from the colleague from IRC, that on the one hand, climate action is most needed in conflict-hit and fragile states because of the interconnectedness between conflict and climate. But the vast majority of climate funding is going in non-fragile states, like 80-90%. So it would be much better to target, of course, these other top crisis contexts. What's the reason for that? And what could we do about that?
The reason that most climate financing is going to the not-so-fragile countries is the same reason that most development funding went to the not-so-poor states during their Millennium Development Goal era. It's because it's easier and you're much more likely to get a return on an investment as a donor. It's more stable, it's safe, you've got a government you can work with. And the climate financing architecture, it's basically determined by the shareholders of these big funds, and they need to ensure that their investments are safe because they need to be accountable to the electorate back home. So yes, it's the kind of very clear pragmatic structural reasons why it's less attractive for a donor to invest in a more fragile state within these, particularly within these kind of multi-donor, they're called the vertical funds, you know, the big climate funds, the Green Climate Fund, Global Environmental Environment Facility.
Is it only a donor government issue? For example, we know from the development from the humanitarian organizations world, of course, it's also easier for agencies or for NGOs to lobby for funding, for private funding, for our donations in settings where they can promise things will work out. There are limited risks. It's a shiny example where you can quickly build something for fundraising, marketing, etc. So do we also have to be less risk averse because the world is as it is and we need to be more honest maybe to the donors and to the people donating on the private side?
Absolutely, yeah. You're 100% right. It's not just donors, but an individual donor or sponsor doesn't want to see that, you know, $10.99 a month has gone into a black hole because that armed opposition group has taken over that community. Absolutely. I don't know the answer of how to do that at the individual kind of donor level. But in terms of the more structured aid, I feel a bit more hopeful. I think there are examples, and there's a real push within the climate financing space to really lobby for more of this climate finance to go to fragile states. And this does then mean that those donors need to become less risk averse. There are models. I mentioned the Peace Building Fund. It's possible with the PBF because it was designed to be rapid and dynamic and effective in these very volatile, fragile contexts where their governance capacity is going to be very questionable. And so they can disperse to unknown entities, non-state entities, maybe non-trusted entities, because usually that's a challenge, right? You can't just partner with local organizations if they don't have form, if they don't have a track record, but just to meet the financial requirements of the climate funds, but also just normal development or humanitarian funding, it's hugely challenging for us, you know, for me sitting in Berlin, just to go through, you know, the procurement processes and the legal requirements. So the threshold is so high. So I think there is a lot of interest within the climate space, since that's a bit of a newer space, these models are not quite locked in, to start to reduce those barriers to entry, start to create incentives within the donor structures to invest in more fragile contexts. And this needs to come right from the top. You know, if your head of state is saying this, then your development agency will have to do it, but it won't happen the other way around.
Final question. It sounds a bit like the, on the one hand, vicious circle that conflict and climate crisis are in a way escalating each other could also be the advantage, because then we can comprehensively target both at the same time if we do the right thing. Is that giving you hope, just to share some hope at the end of this podcast?
Let's see. I suppose so. I don't think in the examples we're talking about that the efforts to address the conflict will help with reducing the climate crisis, because that's about mitigation. And none of these countries that are facing conflict are the big emitters. So I think there's a huge kind of justice argument that says they shouldn't be under this pressure to be thinking about their emissions at the moment, because, you know, most of these countries are it's marginal. But in terms of helping communities adapt or to try to build in preventative measures, I think absolutely there is where the light is shining to ensure that those efforts to prevent climate risks, compounding vulnerability, if they're designed right, can be exactly the kind of thing that can help reduce the risks of conflict.
Janani, many thanks for this positive outlook in a way. Many thanks for not depressing us for the rest of the day or the weeks and years to come. Many thanks for being us. Many thanks for being at the conference and for sharing your great expertise. It was really interesting, and many thanks for joining.
Thank you so much, Ralph. It was a real pleasure.
This is it today from the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action. You can find all relevant links to this session in the show notes. If you have any feedback or a suggestion as to whom should be interviewed here, we'd love to hear that. Just send us an email to info@charberlin.org. Thanks for listening.